Awesome,
South
bro.
Asia.
Awesome.
Very good to have you with us, and thank you for joining. If I could just ask that those people who are just joining just now, if you wouldn't mind going on mute for us so that we can hear our speakers, that would be very much appreciated. My name is Chris Lowry. It's very good to be with you. I'm a managing director with Teneo and head of our Singapore office, and I'll be moderating our discussion today. And I'm very pleased to be joined by two colleagues, Bob Herrera Lim and Aditi Fadnis, and I'll introduce them fully in just a minute. But as a backdrop to this call, Teneo is a CEO advisory firm with a focus on navigating complexity and transformational change for clients. We work with a great many global businesses on their needs in the region, everything from protecting reputations, managing crises, through to understanding political risk and improving employee engagement. Now, clearly COVID-19 is having and has had a significant impact on businesses in South Asia, Southeast Asia, for several reasons. Firstly, many megacities and some of the most populated countries around the world are to be found in the region. The region is also home to some of the fastest growing economies in the world, so countries like Bangladesh, India, and Indonesia. In this region, we also have steadily growing populations, and with that, increasing disposable incomes, meaning that people and populations in this part of the world are increasingly consumers for many of the goods and services produced by global businesses. And finally, the region is also a critical player in the globalized supply chains of many industries, and much of the world's production is based in the region. So disruption to countries in this part of the world is having a significant impact. And in recent weeks, we've seen a number of important developments. So we've had a big jump in COVID numbers, for example, infection rates in Indonesia, which has amongst the highest mortality rates in the world, sadly. India is in the second of 3 weeks of its current lockdown, with the affecting the population of 1 billion people. And we have countries such as Philippines and Malaysia enacting similar measures. The World Health Organization recently warned countries in the region to prepare for large-scale community transmissions. And with that in mind, we brought together two speakers to help us understand the nature of the healthcare challenges facing these countries, get a grasp on how governments are reacting, and the commercial and economic impact. So I'll just introduce our two speakers. Bob Herrera Lim is a managing director with Teneo and our risk advisory business. A former lawyer, he's based in Manila and has been covering the region as an analyst for more than 20 years. He has a particular focus on the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and Vietnam. Aditi Fadnis is one of India's foremost political journalists. She's been a reporter for more than 35 years, covering politics, political economy, defense and foreign policy issues for Indian and foreign newspapers. He's also the author of an edited volume, Political Profiles, published in 2008 by BS Books. And at Teneo, Ms. Fadnis covers political and economic developments in all South Asian countries, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Afghanistan. So in terms of the format for today's call, for the first 35 minutes or so, Bob and Aditi will address a series of points before we then turn over to questions from those of you that have joined the call today. So the way in which we will do that is we will open up such that people can come off mute and raise a question. Equally, we also have an email address if you wish to do so throughout the discussion. If you send an email to reply, R-E-P-L-Y, at teneo.com, we'll be able to pick it up. And as I say, people can also have the option to ask questions at the end. So, without further ado, I'll start with you, Bob, first, if I may. And I thought we could begin by thinking and taking a look across Southeast Asia, clearly a very diverse region. But I wonder if I could just have you invite you to sort of share some reflections on the government responses to date, public expectations, and the different approaches that leadership have been taking in those countries, and perhaps give us some sense as to where this might lead from your perspective.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I hope you can hear me well. And to everyone who's listening, I hope you are well and being safe. So going to your question. So I think, as most of us know, you know, the common mistake for people who are not in the region, and fortunately, many of you are from within or within the region, is that Southeast Asia is not monolithic. It is 10 countries with incomes ranging from the very low to the very high. So capabilities differ. Now, what's happened in Southeast Asia is, because this is a new virus, the perceptions have varied across different governments as to how to deal with it. I think the struggles that the World Health Organization has had in communicating the risk, in dealing with China, have also complicated the situation. And the fact that this is the first, I think, virus that has spread globally in the lifetimes of many people has also added to the confusion. So what you are seeing in the region is the sirens of the virus, what it does, how infectious it is still catching up with the political and social responses and how people see it and how scared they are. So it's difficult for governments to not only manage one thing at a time, it's difficult for them to manage things when impressions are coming in, not just from Asia, but from Europe and the Americas on how this thing is progressing. So I'd say that as a whole in Southeast Asia, the governance level is reflective of how we have seen things evolve. So on the one hand, you have Singapore, Vietnam, and we could even put there Malaysia, as having the combination of relatively effective or visible outbreak response tools, testing, contact tracing, and the ability to signal how they'll deal with the business and economic fallout. Now, nothing is perfect. People complain about things not being done one way or the other, but these are the countries that are on that side of the equation. And then you have countries like Thailand and Cambodia that are in the middle, and Cambodia is in the middle sort of because it has this influenza reporting system that has kicked in. You know, the challenge with many of these countries right now is we can't go to them, so we can't see how effective they are. But Thailand has a good pharmaceutical sector. There are questions about its governance abilities, but as a whole, it's in the middle. Then you have countries like Myanmar, Indonesia, and the Philippines that are still catching up in everything from the ability to trace the virus, to do contact tracing, or to even take care of the most vulnerable. So in a sense, you could say Vietnam is outperforming, Thailand is slightly underperforming, but you could correlate it to governance as a whole. So why do these capabilities matter for the region? The first is just the ability to deal with the outbreak. And second, as we'll discuss later on, to credibly exit from them. And when I say credibly exit from them, in a way that will be facilitative of trade and labor flows in the future. The second is the ability to help the ones who are the most economically likely to suffer. And this is important because given the severity of the economic impact of the virus, we can have real social and political discontent. You know, you can rally people around the flag today, but how long that will last if people are hungry, if people are struggling to regain a sense of normalcy in their lives is going to be very critical for some of the larger countries in the region. And what are the specific risks that we see in these countries? For instance, one are the slums in Manila or the kampungs in Indonesia. As you very well know, these are highly concentrated locations where you have maybe 5,000 to 10,000 people in a square kilometer. And I am pretty sure that we are not catching everything that is happening in these. How then can a country like the Philippines or Indonesia exit a few weeks from now if we are not sure what the status of the virus is in these types of communities? And this is complicated by Indonesia's seeming unwillingness to do the lockdown or hard containment that we have seen in Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. The second are the refugee camps in Bangladesh, although that is in Southeast Asia. It relates to the fact that these are the Rohingya who have been exiled, who have left Myanmar. So there are all these issues that make it difficult to have a very distinct call on where the region is going. And credibility will be important because it will determine how quickly countries can, you know, restore trade and labor flows. This also raises a very interesting question. At some point, how important will surveillance be? Vietnam has been widely touted as an example through the region, despite having none of the resources of the larger communities, but the level of surveillance in Vietnam is extremely high. So just to wrap things up, we are sure that the number of cases are being undercounted in the region. As Chris has said, fatality rates in Indonesia and the Philippines are high. That is not, we don't think that's a function of the virus being worse. We are seeing 7-8% fatality rates in the Philippines and Indonesia, but that is a symptom of overcounting. So throughout the region, we will see different aspects of it starting to evolve. Now, just on a slightly broader level, one thing I think that we will need to study a bit more and look is how societies understand and look at risk. As I said, this is the first pandemic for many people in their lifetime, mine included, although we've watched SARS, we've watched the avian influenza, and people's willingness to tolerate risk will change. The willingness to tolerate risk versus the economic pain is going to change after this. And once we find out what's happened with the virus, people will start saying, did we go over or did we go under? So there's still a lot that can change. I think that's the summary of it, Chris.
Thank you, Bob. That's a very helpful start point. And I want to pick up on something that you started to sort of refer to, which is a situation that might emerge where we have a two-speed recovery, and we have some countries where the curve is flattening, infection rates are starting to come down, as we are seeing in South Korea, where they are, you know, downward trend from the sort of peaks in earlier in February. And then obviously in other countries where they're still increasing considerably. So what kind of challenges and difficulties and issues does that present in a region where the flow of goods and services, trade, migration and labour, as you say, has been so fluid at various points? How might that sort of affect things for business operations and otherwise?
I think what you see is a much more complex region. You know, it was already complex before we even had the virus, right? You had to deal with different labor rules, etc., different customs rules, and there was some hope that RCEP or TPP would help improve the integration. But I think that is off the table for now. I think the guiding word is complexity. It is going to be a much more complex system until we have a vaccine, until the science catches up with perceptions, and until there's a sense of how to approach issues related to the outbreak or healthcare systems in a common manner, whether this will be done through the WHO or through ASEAN or through China's leadership or through, you know, the US leadership or Japan, it's still unclear. So until you have this, you will have different ways of approaching the virus. The second thing I think that is going to be very important is, therefore, as you said, you'll see two worlds almost. One where countries are relatively comfortable with reopening trade, migration, and tourism routes within, you know, maybe within a year. And you would see these countries that have the surveillance systems, that have the ability to contact trace aggressively, that have the ability to test. And so if you're Singapore, a country like Japan would feel comfortable opening up to you. But if you are Indonesia or the Philippines, where you have questions about how effective is contact tracing, you have several hundred habitable islands, how do I know that if somebody comes from an island where, you know, the disease or testing has not happened to the extent that we can determine if the outbreak has been contained, that you fly to Manila and then you fly to Hong Kong or you fly to Singapore, that doesn't create a risk. And that is the risk, because as we've seen in Singapore, as we've seen in Vietnam, countries that were able to deal with what you might call the first wave of infections are now having to deal with the second wave. And many of these, including in China, are international or foreign transmission of the virus. So it's difficult for countries to trust unless there is going to be a system. And who will develop that system? Who will build that system? How will countries agree on that system? And that goes into other issues such as privacy. Let's say I am a Filipino flying from Manila to Singapore. What will Singapore say before you can enter? What will they ask of your medical records, of your health records? How can we synchronize those systems in a way that is not unduly burdensome? I think at the start it will be burdensome. There will be a lot of friction. Okay, we will see a lot of friction in people movements. We might see even friction in goods movements. And this is a problem for the 6 to 12 month horizon, maybe. For the next 2 to 3 weeks, the problem will be more internal, because as Indonesia, Myanmar, Philippines, some of the larger countries try to unwind the restrictions, there's going to be the question of, do you first isolate the more outbreak-ridden cities and focus on opening up the less outbreak-ridden areas? How do you test? So you will have goods issues even within countries, within trade, and that's going to be a challenge as well. So an island in, you know, Java versus other islands in Indonesia, how do they treat each other? How do they lift or not the restrictions? And central governments will say, we want those restrictions lifted. you know, Koh Samui, Phuket might say, no, we fixed this. We don't want Bangkok people because we need the tourism. We're going to seal off Bangkok. We're not going to do these things. So you might see these fights between even sub-regional or sub-local governments. And again, over the longer term, question is China. Thailand depends on China for tourist flows. Yeah. So how will that happen? Then you have Cambodians working in Thailand, Cambodians working in other parts of continental Southeast Asia, Filipinos working in Hong Kong, working in China. The migration flows will be closely scrutinized as well. So how does this affect supply chains? Those are going to be very serious questions that will have to be answered through systems, through coordination, which we are not yet seeing as of now.
And picking up on this point, Bob, both on the international aspect, but also you mentioned China, thinking about two countries in particular that have a very significant importance for the region, the relationship with the US, the relationship with China, thinking about the way in which both those administrations have handled the outbreak, thinking about where the US is right now, how do you see what is happening in both those countries affecting the calibration of relationships between ASEAN countries and countries in Southeast Asia towards the US and towards China?
Okay, so I think we should put out binary outcomes. This is not the U.S. winning and China losing and China winning or the U.S. losing. On the one hand, you have the sense right now in many Southeast Asian countries that the U.S. is focused on its own problems, that it has not acted in a way that fosters regional or even global cooperation. And people are going to say, okay, so we haven't seen the way even the U.S. reacted after the tsunami in 2006. Where you saw a noticeable U.S. presence. So I think the lack of coordination, cooperation hurts the U.S. But at the same time, you also have this narrative that part of the error was in China's early handling of the outbreak. Okay, it tried to make up for this later by going on what you might call healthcare diplomacy, if you want to call it that. But there was a sense early on that China's mishandling of its internal markets, the markets where the virus is presumed to have originated, its willingness to be transparent, etc. All these things will also weigh on the perceptions of Southeast Asia. So, but on the whole, if you ask me, I think the U.S. has been hurt slightly more. So the challenge now for many Southeast Asian countries seeing all this is they will ask themselves, how do I protect my national interest when I can't get a strong sense of leadership from either of the two powers, or I don't fully trust what they will do in the future if something like this happens again? And what will happen with many countries in Southeast Asia is what you might say a sense of, we have to protect our national interest first. So in the same way, maybe with the trade war that you've seen, it will amplify the me first sense in many countries. And there's going to be a sense within ASEAN to try to balance that with some regional cooperation. So you might see Singapore taking a greater lead in coordinating a response. As we saw after the Asian financial crisis, we had the Chiang Mai initiative. So there might be a regional initiative to maybe rationalize how the region deals with it. And Singapore and Vietnam, given how they've responded, would seem to be the natural ones for this, because Vietnam has natural links with Cambodia and Laos. So you get continental Southeast Asia with Vietnam. You get Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia working together. And then Philippines chimes in. So you get sort of two or three groups clustering in Southeast Asia and saying, okay, we will not get a full solution from the U.S. We will not get a full solution from China. We have to find a way to make this work in ASEAN. And that takes time, because ASEAN has a bureaucracy. It's staffed by good people, but they need the political mandate to go beyond their usual work.
Noted. Okay, I guess switching gears for a moment then. So thinking about commercial and economic impacts. If I'm a business, I have manufacturing and production operations across Southeast Asia. How should I be looking at this region in terms of the interconnectivity with global supply chains? What are some of the main preoccupations and considerations that you think are most important to have front of mind?
Okay, I think it highlights two things. The first is companies have to know where their supply chains are, not just at the first level, but beyond that. And that is going to be very challenging because, you know, we have some clients that are in the U.S. and we know that visibility on supply chains as they have moved away from China to a certain extent has become less pronounced. So you might have something that's coming from Thailand, but it's being made in Cambodia. Parts of it are being made in, or parts of it come from Myanmar or Indonesia. How do you then gain visibility, not just at the first degree, but a couple of steps deeper to know that if borders close again, you know where things, where you will take a hit. And again, this goes to our discussion earlier of we might have two worlds, right? So the U.S. might be fine. China might be fine. Europe might be fine. What if we have viral reservoirs in Southeast Asia or in other parts of Asia? Because, again, the contact tracing is late. The testing takes time to catch up. Then, you know, you might be fine getting stuff from Singapore, but then you find out something comes from Cambodia or something comes from Indonesia. So I think that's going to be the first challenge. The second thing that it highlighted is concentration risk. And we saw this in many business process outsourcing centers in the Philippines because of the high level of, and probably see it in India, Aditi can comment on those, because of a large capacity that's been set up in the Philippines to handle calls coming from the U.S., the moment Manila went into lockdown, many of those call centers went dark. Call times in the U.S. went from a couple of minutes to 10 or plus minutes. So I think concentration risk is going to be another concern for many businesses in the South, in Southeast Asia. And so I think all this complexity and assessing this is going to be a challenge. And then, as we said, you have to take a look at labor flows as well. So it's going to be a much, much more complex way of handling your supply chains and looking at it, not just in the way we've been looking at it the past 15, 20 years. You know, many people were surprised when flooding in Thailand in 2011 disrupted auto production in Turkey or, you know, drove hard drive prices up in the United States by, you know, 200-300%. I think if, given that we have this lockdown globally, it's sort of numbed the supply chain effects globally to a certain extent. But if parts of the world are producing and you have sort of complicated or not so easy places to manufacture where you have risks of shutdowns, that's going to be a risk that needs to be managed.
Well, you mentioned supply chains and the prospect of turning some of that over to Aditi. So I will at this point, Bob, pause you there and bring Aditi in. And just a reminder for everybody, if you do have questions, please do send them to us. Reply, R-E-P-L-Y at teneo.com, and we can pick those up. Or I will open it up for people for questions for either Bob or Aditi shortly. But Aditi, just bringing you in at this point, given the sort of connectivity between economies like China and for some of the sort of crucial goods that many much of the production that occurs in India in industries like pharmaceutical are dependent on. What's your perspective on sort of the supply chain impact from the sort of outbreak and you know, not just in ASEAN and the impact into India, but also within India? Perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, supply chains are disrupted as everywhere else. And because China has now begun recovering somewhat, our markets are now increasingly being taken over by China. And this is something that is worrying the government deeply. And I think if the lockdown, which is currently in place in India, which is supposed to be lifted on the 14th, but there is almost a consensus that it will not be lifted on the 14th. If that doesn't happen, then I fear that Indian supply chains are going to be severely compromised and are going to be, exports, pharma, for instance. Pharma is currently the toast of town. As a reporter, we never used to consider pharma even as a proper industry. But now we are making a beeline for the government's version of what is happening in pharma because it's a lifeline now for India's exports. So,
Go ahead.
So, as far as trade is concerned, I fear that there is nothing positive to report. Absolutely nothing, except possibly in the pharma area, where now that China has started functioning and we depend a great deal on supplies from China, even for the pharma industry, we are intermediate producers of pharma. So,
you mentioned the current focus for the government. So the lockdown runs through to the 14th. What's your perspective on the extent to which that is working? And then what is the sort of calculus that the government is depending on in deciding whether or not to extend it? And could it be extended in certain parts of the country, but not nationally? How might that look? What are some of the discussions that are being had around that?
So let me just go back to three issues which divide, three phases actually, which divide the government's management of this crisis. The first phase is, how did we get here? Initially, the government was very happy at its management of the crisis because India was one of the first countries to impose a lockdown, to announce its all its airports were shut, railways stopped functioning. Any mass mobilization was first announced by India, especially from abroad, which meant that the virus could, government took great care to see that the virus would not import it into India. Containment was the subsequent policy, because having once come into India, then the areas which it had visited needed to be segregated and sequestered. So initially, the first phase was that cases were very low in relation. India has 1.38 billion people living here. It's 18% of the world's population. But initially, we had, for the first week or so, we had deaths only in double digit and reported cases only in about under 200. But what happened later was the disaster, which is when an Islamic congregation, which had come from all over the world, was somehow not detected. And members carrying the virus came from all over, from everywhere, and congregated in a very highly dense area. Added to this was the sudden reporting of a sudden spike in the or surge in Mumbai, which gets the largest number of tourists anywhere in India. Its airport gets 65,000 people coming in every day. So despite the lockdown, the virus had already entered India and was spreading very quickly. And then the government announced on 24th March that there would be a total lockdown. In other words, nobody was allowed to move out. Nobody was allowed to come in. All mass transport systems were shut and so on. There is a mixed result as the outcome. In some areas, containment has worked effectively, extremely effectively. In a small area in Bhilwara in Rajasthan, for instance, only one case was detected, and that too has, basically, it is COVID-free now. So they have conquered the disease. But that has not been the case in areas which are very densely populated, and there are areas where a lot of people come from outside. They don't belong to the city, but they come for jobs and then live in the city and then go back. So it's actually a transitional kind of an accommodation. The net result is that right now India has upwards of 5,000 cases, almost 6,000, 5,400 and something at the moment. I guess by the end of the week, it will go up to 6,000. The government is seriously thinking of extending the lockdown, but understands that there is serious economic pain being caused by it. There are some deaths because of starvation. There are some deaths because people who wanted to return home, who are migrants and wanted to return home, found that there was no recourse to transportation and so decided to walk. And so you had this huge population just walking back to their villages. So there has been varying degree of discomfort, and obviously the economy is badly hit. We can discuss the economic numbers in a moment.
Yeah, and just on that point about the economy, I wondered if you could just give some sense of the vectors through which the impact is being felt in terms of in economic terms. I mean, clearly the human side of it is very significant and very sad, but thinking on the economic aspect, we've talked about one component part, which is of course the supply chain. What are some of the other areas in particular that are kind of weighing on that calculus and the decision about whether or not to extend the lockdown?
So internally, in terms of internal damage that the COVID-19 virus has done to the economy just within India, the crisis is extensive. I mean, first of all, the GDP growth is unlikely to be anything more than 1.4 or 1.6%, down around 6% previously. The reason is, of course, that, if you look at the manufacturing clusters, everything is shut. Migrant labor is a very, very important, it's around 100 million people, and it is a very, very important component in industry. And manufacturing plants cannot survive because car manufacturers, for instance, Maruti Suzuki or Ford or Hyundai or Toyota, all these companies have declared a shutdown because they don't have the labor. Migrant labor has just gone back. It will take time for them to return. And the questions being asked by people at this point are, why didn't the government anticipate this return of migrant labor and make in-situ arrangements for these people to stay there? So internally, the situation is very, very bad indeed. In terms of external engagement, in terms of trade, it is marginally better. Those countries where we export final products, like say textiles or gems and gem and jewelry or heavy engineering goods, those will probably once things come back to near normal, we will be able to recapture the markets. But manufacturing continues in Vietnam and Bangladesh, so apparel exports are from India are badly hit because those markets are immediately, Vietnam and Bangladesh are very moving very quickly to take over those markets. In terms of export of commodities, like say tea or rice, unfortunately, India's tea exports are going to be badly hit because I'm seeing reports that the first flush Darjeeling tea is completely destroyed because there's no labor to pick it. So that is a huge hit that the tea industry will take. Similarly for coffee. But this is a short-term blip. In the future, these are commodities which are peculiar to India. And I don't think there's any other country in the world that can replace things like Darjeeling tea and basmati rice. So people are not too worried about that. It's the intermediate goods that people are worried about. Intermediate goods, for instance, elements which are parts in, semiconductor chips, for instance, which form part of IT hardware. Already, we are hearing that the IT hardware production facilities are closed and orders are being cancelled. So as a result, China is working. So China is taking over the shortfall, say to Germany or to somewhere else, which is being caused because India is not able to produce.
And what are some of the measures then that the government is looking at to try and counteract these events? There's been talk, hasn't there, of fiscal stimulus. I see that there are sort of suggestions of some measures being taken to support particular industries, such as incentivizing investment in local supply chains in pharmaceuticals, for example. Are there any particular measures that stand out for you that you think stand to sort of support and address some of these challenges?
The government initially took measures which were, I hesitate to use the word, but kind of socialist, because they needed to protect the lowest level of the consumer and the and its people. So there were cash grants being offered to people below a certain income level. There were free food being offered, or subsidized, highly subsidized food offered to below poverty families, and so on. This was followed by a kind of a stimulus. It was not exactly a stimulus, but a kind of loosening of the purse strings by the Reserve Bank of India. This was around $1.7 trillion, as far as I can remember. And the stimulus meant that the reverse repo and the repo rates were reduced, which meant that banks did not require to have the cash that they were normally required to keep. And this meant that they had more capacity to give, to lend money. There was a temporary moratorium on, equated monthly installments on your housing loans or education loans, but of course, and credit card loans. But of course, the interest kept on running. So frankly, it was your choice. You wanted to pay it all together at the end with interest, or, stagger it. So this was not, this is not the final stimulus. This is not the net stimulus that everyone's waiting for. Right now, government is toying with the idea of announcing another package, particularly for the medium, small, and mini industries, which are typically very small, mom and pop kind of establishments with maybe 10 or 20 people, but they're crucial in keeping supply chains alive. So big auto companies rely on ancillaries, which form a very big part of these small, medium, and mini industries. So we should expect to hear something from the government in the next, I think in the coming week.
Got it. And I guess a final question before I'll open it up to the group to see if people have questions for either Bob or Aditi. Just a question about the challenges of testing. And, you alluded to the size of the country, 18% of the world's population, 1.38 billion people. A huge sort of geographic dispersity of people across rural and urban communities. What is happening in India in terms of testing and sort of being able to track and trace the spread of the virus? What does that look like, given the sort of the just sheer scale of the geography and also the population that we're talking about?
It's a challenge, but actually I don't think it's as big a challenge as people imagine it is. Because India at the moment is relying on containment. In many rural areas, nobody has been infected. There's no chance of it being infected. So, and that is why the government is considering staggered lifting of the lockdown. But testing is an issue, but I don't think it's as big an issue as people imagine it is. That said, testing is expensive. The cheapest way to test costs up to 1,800 rupees, which is almost $30, which is a lot of money for an ordinary Indian. A higher level of testing, which is called PCR, costs up to upwards of 5,000 rupees. There is no free testing unless you can prove that you have the virus. But then how do you prove that you have the virus without being tested? So this is a problem. And once we open up, this is going to be a bigger problem, because the government is telling factories and manufacturing establishments that you must have thermal scanners before you open the factory. And thermal scanners have suddenly, surprise, surprise, gone underground.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll be watching closely then. So the 14th is the date that the lockdown runs until. So we'll see what the government says in the coming days around that, as well as some more in terms of the economic situation. Thank you both, Bob and Aditi. I guess at this point, what I will do is I will open up to our participants. And offer up if anyone has any questions for either Bob or Aditi based on what you've heard, or anything specifically you'd like to ask, then now is the time to do so. And I'll just check to see if we've had any in our inbox. Let's have a look. Does anybody have any questions at this point?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi there. Maybe that's not a question. If you don't have any questions, would you mind making sure your phone is on mute? Thank you. Bob, I have a question here for you. Question about the fact that we've heard and we've seen some very interesting, I suppose, examples of innovation from businesses around the world in trying to tackle perhaps retooling facilities. There was the sort of widely reported instance of LVMH that repurposed factories for sanitizer. New Balance in the US has repurposed the factory that produces for trainers to make masks. Have either of you sort of encountered or seen any interesting instances of private sector enterprises and innovation such like, you know, in this region, in Southeast or South Asia, in terms of businesses that are sort of taking the opportunity to reformulate or reformat their approaches?
I can go ahead. Yeah, so I think given where we are in the contagion, that many businesses right now are just still starting to figure out how to operate as close to normal as they can be. Obviously, some facilities are being repurposed to serve as hospitals and to take in patients. But I think the longer term consequence of this is in many of the Southeast Asian countries, healthcare will become almost seen as a strategic industry for the next few years, where the ability to not only have your own production of PPEs will be seen as important, critical, the ability to secure those supplies, but also the ability to treat patients, not just in the capitals, but outside as well, to prevent metropolitan areas from being overburdened. So I think that's where we are right now. Some, such as Vietnam, have shown their ability to produce what they need to produce relatively quickly, but that's more a function of their existing capacity than anything else.
Yeah, in terms of innovation in business, we are seeing some amount of app-based innovation. There are many ways in which medical apps are being developed, which can actually tell you whether you have the infection or not, based on parameters other than testing your blood. But these are very, very few and far between. And right now, I think most businesses are wondering how to cope with the problem of attrition, how to cope with the problem of keeping jobs there alive, what to cut, what not to cut. I don't think there is too much innovation possible in those areas.
Very good. Thank you, Aditi. Bob, I've got another question from a participant here. In terms of how the outbreak could affect national policies in the region, so there's been a lot of talk about the state playing a bigger role. Clearly, that has implications in terms of raising revenues to fund an expanded state. I wonder if you could sort of say a bit about that. So how might that play out in South Asia? Southeast Asia, sorry.
So the state, as you know, has spent a lot of money, and they will continue to spend a lot of money on healthcare, on preparing for a possible recurrence of this virus, maybe next year. So it implies that the state itself will play a bigger part, and that's going to be a demand by the citizenry on their states, and that means they will have to raise revenues. The second thing is building up strategic supplies, whether you are talking of healthcare equipment, whether you're talking of food supplies and the ability to store food, All these things will, I think, acquire greater importance for many countries because simply we've had, you know, it's the consequence of borders being closed, of people's movements not being as fluid as they could be, and the disruptions that these have caused. So I think in the future, this will all have to be paid, and states will try to increase their tax revenues. They will try, you know, some of them will discuss more privatizations. Maybe some less important segments of the economy will have to be sold off to give way to these types of priorities. But definitely, given the fact that no government in the future will want to be seen as being negligent in preparing for a recurrence of this for the next 2 to 3 years. We saw the same behavior during the Asian financial crisis, where for 4 to 5 years, the only thing you could hear from many Southeast Asian governments was how to prepare for the next financial crisis. For the next 3 to 5 years, you will hear from many Southeast Asian governments the statement of how to prepare for the next healthcare crisis. And that is going to involve a lot of state involvement in terms of dictating where resources go and how to fund all of these programs.
Yeah. And any reflections from you, Aditi, on that point about preventing longer term fallout and infections and sort of being seen to ensure that this doesn't happen again? What's the position as you see it in India on that point?
At this point, people are deeply worried about the second and third wave of the infection. And okay, we coped and we managed somehow the first wave. But if immunity is not developed and if your antibodies are not developed to that extent, and given the low levels of general health robustness among Indians, this is what is worrying government a lot. In India, health is a concurrent subject. The state central government, the federal government handles it, as well as the state governments. And a lot depends on the capacity of the state governments to take care of the second and third wave. And that is why state governments are arguing very strongly that the lockdown should not be lifted, because they don't want the virus to be imported from other areas and form a second wave or a third wave.
And just picking up on that point, there's been a lot of debate, hasn't there, I guess, within the government about where is the harm greatest? Is it the pandemic itself, or is it a population, you know, sections of which are facing or stricken by major poverty and other health challenges like tuberculosis and so on? I just wonder if you might say a bit more about that, because that's clearly a very considerable and significant challenge. You know, for a government to have to contend with that is not straightforward at all.
Well, tuberculosis is certainly a problem, and but we were managing it somehow. This pandemic is harder to manage because it's invisible. You really don't know where it's traveling from, where it's going, and from where to expect the challenge. So it's an unknown. And India is not good at managing unknown unknowns. So we have to now, state governments will now possibly ramp up expenditure for healthcare. But, you know, these things have a gestation period. You can't just set up a hospital overnight. You can't get doctors overnight. So, and then if they're not needed, what do you do with those facilities? So, I think right now the effort is on somehow managing and containing it, and then focusing on how to remove it altogether.
Can I just ask Aditi to say something? Hello. Yes, we have a question. Hello.
Yeah, I have a question. This is Moses Tang. First of all, my comment is that I realized a lot of leaders in different countries have kind of used this coronavirus situation to their own domestic audience, and even within United States, I see a lot of back and forth being very polarized. Current administration may use this as a way of blaming certain other groups or countries. Although, you know, Susan Rice have made it clear in one of his clips, I saw that the current administration had warning back in October that, you know, there could be potential of these things happening. Even the Bush administration have actually said that we got to prepare for it. And I want to know the facts, because facts should be, as they say, the truth will take out all the politics. When I was told that China, in the beginning of December, examining the Wuhan situation, by in 2 or 3 weeks already have notified WHO and notified counterparts of the situation, and sequencing has already been given by the beginning of January. Is that true? I see a lot of information, but I'm just curious if people know if that is true. That's one.
Yeah.
And it's good to know. If it is indeed true, then, you know, we shouldn't be hearing Steve Bannon's commentary that China is actually scheming these virus warfare, chemical warfare, in this Wuhan situation in particular. A second question I want to know, if people can help me understand factually, is India actually petitioning to the World Court regarding China developing this virus as a result hurting the world population? Anybody know about these two?
I can answer the first one, and Aditi can take the second one.
Thank you.
So just on the China situation, yes. So by early January, they had sequenced the genome. And in fact, this is one of the reasons Germany was able to develop its tests early and why Germany was able to test very early. Now, insofar as Mr. Bannon and all the politicization, I think whenever things like this happen, you know, it feeds into confirmation bias. So whether, you know, we would like to assume that people are rational and that we gather all the information and then we make an intelligent decision or an intelligent assessment. We as political scientists and political analysts know that that is not always the case in the world. And therefore, narratives are very important. And, you know, the narrative in this case has been obviously muddled by conflicting accounts. And I'm saying accounts, I'm not saying truths. Conflicting accounts of, oh, was this in Italy before China? Did the U.S. make a mistake of not closing its borders to China? These are all things that in the rush of a pandemic get lost in the narratives. And I think this is very important for many companies and for many businesses, because these narratives will continue to change over the next 2 to 3 months about, has the WHO been responsible? Has China been transparent? Is the U.S. acting irresponsibly in the region by diverting all production to the United States? I would like a world where people are rational and we act all on information, but that is simply not the case. So it is a challenge for the region. It is a challenge for organizations like ASEAN, the World Health Organization, and it's going to be a continuing facet of this outbreak for the next few months. Aditi?
Yeah, factually, I don't think the Indian government is thinking of going to the World Court.
Okay, so that's fake news.
Okay. So we're coming to the top of the hour. I guess all that remains for me to do then is to say thank you to Bob and Aditi for your time. If I gather a great many of you are receiving our daily update notes on the COVID situation, so we will continue as a firm to track this very closely, working with clients and colleagues to try and make sense of this as we go. So thank you to everybody for your participation. And if you had any further questions or there's anything that that you were looking to us to sort of also consider, please do also get in touch with us after this call. But Bob, thank you. Aditi, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for taking part this afternoon. Very good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.